Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two segments today, no surprise there. Alex Vitale, whose The End of Policing is just out in an updated second edition from Verso, will talk about cops, what they do, and why we need many fewer of them. And the economist Barry Eichengreen offers a defense of public debt, government borrowing, at a time when we're producing almost immeasurably vast gobs of it. In the summer of 2020, the country was alive with calls to defund the police. That defunding phrase itself was never a winner. Too ambiguous, too negative, too off-putting for mass appeal. What it's bad shorthand for is shifting money and people away from cops and towards more humane interventions. As Alex will tell us shortly, cops spend most of their time handling problems that would be far better handled with social supports rather than what Lenin called special bodies of armed men having prisons at their command. The positive aspect gets occluded by the slogan, defund the police. Alex Vitale is a professor of sociology at Brooklyn College who specializes in the study of police. His first book, City of Disorder, How the Quality of Life Campaign Transformed New York Politics, was published in 2009. It focused on how Rudy Giuliani's mayoralty sanitized the city on behalf of the affluent. His second book, The End of Policing, was published by Verso in 2017. The book is an examination of how modern policing came about and what the social role of cops is, mainly enforcing our system of race and class hierarchies. They do surprisingly little to fight crime. The book is just out in a second edition from Verso with new material that addresses developments in cop politics over the last few years. Alex Vitale. It's been a while. Police politics have gone through quite a lot of changes over the years. I want to get to that, but before we do, I want to talk some of the historical stuff. I know we talked about this when the book came out, but it doesn't hurt to go back over it again. Where did what we think of as the modern police force come from? When and where and how did it originate?
There is a standard kind of liberal myth telling of this that says that in 1829, Sir Robert Peel, Robert Bob, the Bobbies, created the London Metropolitan Police, and that this was a huge advance for the rule of law, the civilianization of force and professionalization and policing by consent and all this stuff. But this kind of leaves out an important part of the history, which is where did Robert Peel get this idea from? Well, it turns out he was in charge of the English occupation of Ireland. And during the Napoleonic Wars, they were short on troops to manage resistance to English colonialism. And so Peel invents the Irish Peace Preservation Force, which becomes this kind of hybrid force that is embedded in communities, is proactive, and more efficiently suppresses so-called agricultural outrages of resistance against colonialism. And then he imports that to London to manage one of the other major sources of economic exploitation of the 19th century, which is the management of the massive influx of rural workers displaced by the enclosures movement and forming them into a stable working class by the suppression of their unions, the micromanagement of their disorderly public behavior. That's this combining of colonialism and industrialization.
The colonial angle is interesting because, you know, Stuart Schrader's book, he makes the important point that policing was a very important part of U.S. imperial policy, exporting policing abroad. But this link between policing and imperial warfare just seems to be very deep and longstanding.
Yes, it's really at the origins of this. Basically, what you have when we create modern policing, it's in response to the modern systems of economic exploitation during that period, which are colonialism, industrialization, and of course, slavery. So in the southern part of the US, policing emerges in relationship to the management of slavery, primarily actually in the urban centers. We hear this talk about, oh, well, policing comes from slave patrols. Well, not exactly. It comes from the management of urban mobile slave populations that work outside the home of their owners, who traveled the streets to wharves and warehouses in places like Charleston and Savannah and New Orleans. And policing is created to keep an eye on and micromanage the public behavior of this mobile slave population. But that has very little to do with the origins of policing in Chicago and Boston, which has to do with the management of an influx, a massive influx of immigrant, mostly rural, uneducated, poor people who, like with London, are being molded into a stable industrial workforce. Finally, we had our own form of domestic colonial policing, which is out west. Forces like the Texas Rangers were created to drive out and exterminate indigenous populations to make way for white settlement.
And it's almost too obvious a point to make, but race has been extremely central to American policing from the start.
Well, so of course, it's obvious in the Southern and Western stories, but even in the Northern stories, right, those influxes of rural immigrants were not always considered to be white. The Irish, Italians, Jews were not considered white. And so the policing of those populations in the early 19th century was also highly racialized.
Okay, getting into the present, this is something I've often wondered about. I've seen little things here and there about it, but how do cops spend their days, you know, in a big urban police force or a smaller suburban police force or rural police force? How do cops pass the time? What do they do?
We have studies of 911 data, and we've done observational studies, though not nearly enough of them. And over half of what police do is managing problems that aren't even against the law. They're social work problems. In some estimates, it's as high as 75% of police time is spent on entirely non-criminal matters. And the estimates...
Such as what?
Such as a noise disputes between neighbors, a homeless person freezing to death on the sidewalk, kids hanging out on the corner, none of which are criminal matters. Improperly parked cars, a kid who's lost, an elderly grandparent who wanders off. And that's been my experience riding around in the back of patrol cars for years, is that officers themselves describe the job as 99% boredom and 1% sheer terror. And frankly, even that is a gross exaggeration. Most police officers make about one felony arrest a year, and that's true here in New York City. And most studies show that police spend between 1 and 5% of their time dealing with anything that we would consider serious crime.
So they're doing things that other people could do more humanely for almost all their entire workday.
That's correct.
Now onto the politics of the police reform movement or abolition movement, whatever you want to call it as an umbrella term. The New York Post, my source of all kinds of sensational right-wing news, had an item the other day saying that a survey, an internal survey, I believe it was, that the Post mysteriously got a hold of, showed that the cops have very, very low morale these days, that half of them wish they had never joined the force. What are we to make of this?
This has been true for 100 years. Whenever police are asked about their job, they report low morale. It's not really that variable.
I know a lot of academics who say the same thing.
It has been consistent. This low morale is then weaponized whenever they come under criticism. And of course, what is their solution to low morale? To give them more money and less oversight.
Why are they so miserable? What are they miserable about? What do they complain about?
Well, first of all, it's not clear that they are so miserable, right? They know that they're weaponizing their displeasure for their own advantage. So I don't think we can take the self-reporting of morale at face value. But also, too many people go into policing believing that that is how they solve society's problems. This is how they transform communities. This is how they keep people safe. But in fact, they don't accomplish any of those things. Instead, what they do is they immiserate the poorest and most vulnerable people in our society. And that contradiction weighs on them. Yeah, makes their work lives miserable and mostly pointless.
A generous interpretation of what their position is that they're expected to deal with the consequences of an extremely violent and polarized society, which is essentially an impossible job at that street level.
It's true, but it's not just the violence and polarization, because they actually don't deal with very much of that. What they do is they deal with homeless people and someone having a mental health crisis and someone experiencing an overdose and some poor person whose car doesn't work right, trying to get to work, causing, you know, a traffic hazard while they're, you know, while the police are looking for marijuana. You know, it's just they're engaged in the lives of very poor people in completely counterproductive ways.
A little over a year ago, summer of 2020, it seemed that we were really on the verge of a serious police reform moment. And by police reform, I don't mean the classic, you know, liberal stuff about body cameras and better training, all that, but, you know, real serious investigation of what the cops do and what they should do and how to deal with them. That seems to have dissipated over the last year, year and a half. Is it right to see that, or is there more going on under the surface?
Yeah, there's a lot more going on under the surface. So there was this concerted political and media backlash against defund the police as a slogan and concept. But if you look concretely across the country, what you see is every day another city gets rid of its school police, creates a non-police crisis response team, puts more money into community-based anti-violence efforts. And that is what the movement has actually been calling for, is those concrete transformations city by city. So while Biden says he's against defund the police, he's also putting in $5 billion into community-based anti-violence efforts. In fact, I have a meeting with Senator Schumer later today to talk about how that money should be spent.
What are you going to tell him?
Well, I'm going to tell him that we have a lot of ideas about community-based interventions that are independent of policing, things like advanced peace that identifies high-risk individuals, offers them stipends to participate in pro-social activities, gives them bonuses if they stick with the program. This has been incredibly successful out in California. We've got these violence interrupter programs that have shown tremendous progress. We need financial supports for families in crisis. And also what we don't need is things like Operation Ceasefire, which is this focused deterrent stuff where they identify high-risk individuals and then they constantly threaten and harass them and give them extra punishments and all the rest, which has been all the rage over the last 10 or 15 years.
I'm speaking with Alex Vitelli, author of The End of Policing, just out in an updated second edition from Verso. The Post, once again, is making a lot out of the fact that the Waukesha, is that how you pronounce that town? The guy who ran over the people at the parade in Wisconsin the other day. The perp, or alleged perp, was released on very low bail by a reforming prosecutor. And, of course, they're going to bang away at this and any other similar event that emerges where somebody gets released and then bad things happen. This is going to be inevitable. And the Post article on the topic actually quotes the prosecutor saying, yeah, this is going to happen. Nothing you can do about it. But how do you deal with this? How do you respond to these kinds of sensational events that the right wing is going to go crazy with?
Well, we need to reduce the role of lawyers in rethinking how we produce public safety, because unfortunately, the kind of bail reform thing has, I think, been mishandled. And the reason is that the focus has been solely on decarceration, which, of course, I support. I want to have fewer people incarcerated. I mean, I would like to have no people incarcerated. But we cannot achieve that by merely opening the gates, because people are in crisis. Their lives are incredibly disordered. They have experienced profound trauma in their lives, and they need help. They don't just need to be sent home. Some people should just be sent home, but a lot of people need support. And so to say that our choices when dealing with someone who's engaged in domestic violence is indefinite incarceration or nothing is a totally unproductive choice. So what resources are there to actually help address domestic violence dynamics in the community. It turns out almost none. And so families don't report things to the police. They deal with the abuse until it reaches a total crisis point. And then the result is that someone gets arrested and put in the criminal legal system, which also has nothing to offer people. So the whole dynamic is completely misguided. And to say that this is the result of a failure of bail reform is to paper over the fact that we have a complete failure in how we protect families from abuse.
So when we talk about defunding the police, we're talking about shifting money away from law enforcement, as we traditionally conceive of it, towards what kinds of interventions, these sorts of social service interventions?
Well, it depends on what we're talking about. But whatever it is we're talking about, I think we need to understand that we're dealing not just with some kind of immediate social services intervention. We also have to address the longer term structural forces that are driving these problems. And so if you listen carefully to what folks in abolitionist circles are saying, they're saying we need radical social transformation. But in the meantime, we need to reduce the burden of policing and replace it with alternatives in as many ways as we can. And that in the process of doing that, we actually build momentum for these longer term structural transformations. So we need to quit criminalizing homeless people. We need to deal with the long term problems of mass homelessness. But in the meantime, we can put in place some systems to mitigate the worst harms for both the unhoused person and the communities that they are living in, like a homeless drop-in center that provides showers and a mail drop and a place to store important papers and prescriptions and a social worker to help people access food stamps and other basic benefits, all of which improves the life of the unhoused person and reduces that person's harmful impact on the surrounding community. It's not a solution to homelessness, but it pushes back against this right-wing anti-disorder backlash that drives some of the most reactionary and conservative politics.
Now, there does seem to be reluctance on the left to talk about crime at all and its damage to people and communities. That seems unwise. We shouldn't really avoid the topic. We should just try to approach it differently.
That's right. I mean, this was a big debate in the 1960s and 70s between what was referred to as the left realists and the left idealists. And the left idealists said it's counterproductive to talk about crime because crime is just an authentic expression of working class alienation, and that we should basically more or less ignore the issue in favor of building a workers' struggle for total social transformation. And the left realist said, now, wait a second, this crime affects primarily working class people. And when it is not addressed, it foments right-wing backlash, calls for law and order. It empowers our political enemies. So we need to have concrete strategies to reduce the impact of this on our communities, but rooted in a logic that prefigures these broader social transformations that we're working towards.
I took a constitutional law course in college with Alexander Bickel, who was a Yale Law School's resident conservative. But he said there's a saying in the trade, hard cases make bad law. And so whenever you bring up these sorts of humane reduction of police kinds of policies, they'll say, what about depraved criminals, you know, child rapists, mass murderers, all that sort of thing? What are you going to do about them? Are these the hard cases that make bad law that really make it very difficult for us to think about the larger subject more constructively? What do you do about that?
I'm not sure. I mean, you're absolutely right that those cases are mobilized by critics who don't want to address what people are really saying. And I agree with the larger point. If you look at Fourth Amendment law, you know, the erosion of the Fourth Amendment is driven by terrible cases, right? Mostly involving drugs. The thing is that it's a myth to say that abolitionist organizers don't have anything to say to that. They have lots to say to that. And I recommend in particular Derica Purnell's amazing new book, Becoming Abolitionists. She herself lived in a community with high levels of violence and death, and policing was of no help. And she's demanding interventions that actually produce public safety in a way that policing just doesn't in those communities.
And then there's the gun problem. We have guns everywhere in this country. Can we get serious about decarceration and decopification as long as there are these millions of guns floating around?
Well, of course, the prevalence of armed policing and the prevalence of widespread prevalence of guns in our societies are part of the same dynamic. You know, they're not independent variables of each other. They're both a product of a long history of intense social and political violence at the heart of American history. And so defending the continued intensive use of weapons by police is certainly not a strategy for reducing the centrality of guns in American life. The solution to this is not to imagine tomorrow we're going to like take guns away from all the police. That's not going to happen. But what it means is we need to replace armed interventions as the primary strategy in as many things as we possibly can as quickly as possible. So that means getting armed police out of schools, getting them out of the drug business by legalizing drugs, getting them out of the sex work business by decriminalizing sex work, right? Getting the police out of mental health response, getting them out of traffic response. All of this reduces the number of guns in circulation, the number of people with guns, but it also reduces the ideology, the mindset that says that the way we address every problem is to introduce more guns into the dynamic, which is how we get stand your ground and open carry laws and what happened with the Rittenhouse case.
Yeah, the political environment doesn't seem too fertile for that kind of approach right now, I'm sorry to say. But the kinds of reforms you're talking about, which are, of course, certainly achievable, it's not utopian. But if we wanted really longer-term reimagining of the role of cops in a society, and having a justice system that's not a criminal justice system, but you know actually does deal in actual justice, can it happen without something approaching a revolution in social policy? You know, expanded welfare state, employment guarantees, reduced polarization of incomes, less structural racism. It would really take a very, very serious overhaul of society to have a really serious impact on how police work.
Essentially, you're correct, but I think that we should not underestimate the degree to which we could substantially reduce the scope and intensity of policing while we work to that point. Like I mentioned earlier, there are just dozens of cities just canceling their school police departments. And that is not requiring a broad social revolution. And it is going to make kids safer. And it is going to reduce the kind of legitimacy of an authoritarian mindset about how we address the problems of young people. So let's chip away on as many of these things as we possibly can, but we do it in a logic that says this is part of how we build for these broader transformations. I think as Ruth Wilson Gilmore has said, you know, abolition is about everything. You're absolutely right. It is about these longer term transitions, transformations. But we have to get there by building concrete realities for people that are prefigurative, that are rooted in ideologies of care and solidarity, not coercion, control, and violence.
That was Alex Vitale, a professor of sociology at Brooklyn College and author of The End of Policing, just out in the second updated edition from Verso. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Thank you. That was some of La Rappel des Oiseaux, which I believe means Birds Calling Back and Forth, by Jean-Philippe Rameau, performed by Christophe Rousset. Next, public debt. Back in the misty past, there used to be lots of moralizing around the topic. We were stealing from our children, contributing to moral laxness, falling prey to indiscipline, and many other such sins. That sort of discourse has waned as governments around the world borrowed heavily to deal with the COVID crisis. The finger-wagging austerians are almost nowhere to be found these days except on the far right. Even Germany, that paragon of fiscal virtue, has been running large deficits, though nothing like ours, to be fair. But the finger-waggers will be back, especially if this current surge of inflation continues. Barry Eichengreen is a professor of economics and political science at Berkeley, who specializes in historical perspectives on money and finance. He's the co-author, along with Asma El-Ghanani, Rui Estevez, and Chris James Michener, of In Defense of Public Debt, which was published by Oxford University Press in September. It's an examination of some 2,000 years of borrowing by governments, from city-states of ancient Greece to the U.S. and other rich countries today. The book's central message is that borrowing has been essential to state formation and governance, though war, one of the prime reasons states have borrowed, is nothing to be too pleased about. Sometimes states borrow too much and creditors lend too much, an angle that moralists often forget, which can lead to problems, sometimes very serious problems. Eichengreen was on Behind the News in 2018 to talk about his book, The Populist Temptation, which was published early in the mass anxiety attack over Trump's presidency. And when I say anxiety attack, I'm not excluding myself from the victims. He also talked about his 2010 book, Exorbitant Privilege, a review of the central role of the U.S. dollar in the global economy. Debt warriors obsess, when their worries are in season, about the loss of that privileged status for the dollar, which allows us to borrow more freely than we would be able to otherwise, and which insulates us from currency crises, which often affect less imperially favored countries. Barry Eichengreen. Debt has long carried a moral valence, as you point out in the book. The German word for debt, Schuld, also means guilt. There may be a German joke lurking in there somewhere. But this is a very wrong way to look at the history of public debt, isn't it?
I think it is the wrong way. Debt is also an instrument that the state can use to meet emergencies. So if you go back in history, you see states, kings, sovereigns borrow in order to mobilize resources to defend the realm. You see the Italian city-states of Venice and Siena in the 14th century borrowing in order to meet the public health emergency that was the Black Death. That's the right way to think about public debt as an instrument of the state.
Of course, those wars weren't always defensive. They were colonial and offensive wars as well.
Indeed.
State debt has a very, very long history. You take it back to some of the city-states of ancient Greece were users of debt.
Indeed. Aristotle writes about how Dionysus of Syracuse borrowed in order to help mobilize resources to fight his enemies.
The Romans less so?
The Romans less so because I think they were able to mobilize resources through other means. Roman coins circulated throughout the empire, so they were able to use the equivalent of the central bank printing press to mobilize resources. The Romans' ideology then, just like Germans' ideology today, inclined them against debt finance as intrinsically undesirable, immoral.
And while we're talking about ancient empires, China, what did they have an early history with debt or not?
No, they didn't. So in the book, we are self-consciously and unfashionably Eurocentric because the early history of state debt or public debt is European. It's not Chinese. That contrast reflects the very different political geographies of the two continents. So Europe has always been divided into scores, even hundreds of city-states and territorial states, whereas China was unified under the Qing dynasty from 224 BC, if I recall my dates accurately. And that different political geography reflected differences in physical geography. Europe is a continent divided by mountain ranges and river valleys. China is east of the Himalayas, a great plain which made it possible for successive dynasties to unify the empire and construct a great wall along its northern border to keep out potential invaders.
Debt receded in Europe for quite some time, but around the year 1000, it started coming back, right? Italian city-states?
Right. So there had been a period when, an anomalous period, when much of Europe was unified for a time. The Carolingian Empire, it was called, but after the 9th century of the Common Era, that empire disintegrated. Meanwhile, you had other developments, the rise of commercial powers, seagoing powers like the city-states of Venice and Genoa, that in, as they became commercial powers, you had banking houses that were able to mobilize finance and lend not only locally, but internationally. So the bankers of the Italian city-states in the 13th, 14th, 15th centuries lent to successive kings of England, famously to Edward III during the Hundred Years' War, to mixed effect, if you will, in terms of profitability. But that's really when you begin to see the rise of early modern and later modern public debt, not only nationally, domestically, but internationally.
And that Italian lending was financed by what, the surpluses of mercantile activities? It's not, they were not industrialists in like the modern sense.
That's correct. So these were seagoing powers engaged in trade throughout the Mediterranean that were able to amass a surplus that the bankers could draw on and lend.
What about further north in Europe? When did they get on the state debt bandwagon?
You begin to see territorial states like the Netherlands and England put in place the political as well as the commercial and financial preconditions for the state beginning to be able to borrow, really in the 17th and 18th centuries. So just like Genoa and Venice had been preeminent naval powers, you get the Dutch and the Dutch East India Company, you get the English and the English East India Company in subsequent centuries. So they developed the commercial and financial resources that bankers and investors can lend and the state can borrow. But importantly, they put in place political preconditions. So the problem with sovereign borrowing, where the sovereign is, of course, another name for the king, is that the king was the highest earthly power. Louis XIV famously made the point when he said, "The state is me." Sounds better in French, I paraphrase. But the point is, there was nothing to prevent Edward III or Louis XIV from repudiating his debts. There was no higher power until you begin to get political checks and balances in the form of Republican parliament or legislature. So you get that in the Netherlands with the establishment of the Estates General, basically a parliamentary body in which creditors, important landowners, and investors sat. And you got that over a period of time in England, culminating in the Glorious Revolution in 1688, which strengthened the powers and the prerogatives of the creditors, of investors, and constrained the crown, which might have otherwise been tempted to renege on its debts. And those political checks and balances, in turn, enabled the state to borrow. So there's an important contrast between the English on the one hand and the French on the other, where French parliaments didn't have the same power as the English parliament. French kings couldn't borrow to mobilize resources to the same extent. So in the 17th and 18th century, at the same time, France is three times as large as England in terms of population and economy. The English are able to fight them to a standstill or even defeat them in repeated wars because of the English king's greater ability to borrow and mobilize resources.
You'd think that mere bankers would have a hard time collecting on a state. The state has all the guns and the power and law behind it. So how did it come to be that creditors earned this kind of pretty heavy political influence?
The king and the state understood that they depended on the creditors. So the creditors' most immediate prerogative was the ability to say no mas, to say we will not lend more to you until you make good on your earlier debts. And one way of making good was by extending political concessions. So the story of the Glorious Revolution in England is complicated. That political revolution really unfolded over a period of centuries, not only in 1688, but it was partly that at the same time that the creditors depended on the king for their solvency, the king depended on the creditors for the liquidity and the resources needed to defend the realm and retain the throne.
Almost for the first, this kind of lending, sovereign debt, has been international, right? It financed from a very long time, for at least 1,000 years. It's been a very much cross-border affair.
Indeed, it has. We spoke a little bit earlier about the Bardi and the other Italian bankers who were lending to English kings or to Italian popes, Italian and French popes. There, that history goes back at least millennium. And it points to what is distinctive about state or sovereign debt, namely sovereign immunity, that the borrower is in a different political and judicial jurisdiction where you can't take legal resource if you're a lender in order to enforce your rights. And that's basically the same today, of course. We have a doctrine of sovereign immunity, which means that if Argentina, the government of Argentina, announces that it can't repay what it's borrowed on international financial markets, basically, Argentina is immune from litigation except in its own courts. And we know that the government of Argentina is not going to permit foreign creditors to sue it in its own courts.
But of course, there was gunboat diplomacy. China, in particular, experienced a whole lot of that.
Not only China, the United States in the Caribbean and Central America, the Europeans in Venezuela, in the Ottoman Empire. There are many examples of that. My own view and our view in the book is that often gunboat diplomacy, the intervention of governments using military means in these sovereign debt controversies. Sovereign debt was often only a pretext. So the Brits famously bombarded Alexandria and seized financial assets in Egypt in the 1860s and 1870s. But the real reason was they wanted control of the Suez Canal. And similarly, the United States wanted to keep the Europeans out of the Caribbean. So sovereign debt problems were taken as a pretext for sending in the gunboats and fending off the French and the Germans and others who might have had an interest in our backyard.
I'm speaking with the economist Barry Eichengreen, co-author of In Defense of Public Debt, just out from Oxford University Press. The development of sovereign debt has proceeded side by side with the development of financial markets, right? They really seeded the development of financial markets and promoted them, not just for state debt instruments, but the broader financial system as well, right?
Yeah, so that's one of the points we think is underemphasized and that we highlight in the book, that the development of markets on which government bonds, government debt securities can be traded was an important foundation stone for the development of private financial markets in which people can and companies can borrow and lend for other purposes. So there's a gigantic literature out there about why Europe was first. Why was Europe first to undergo the transition to modern economic growth? Why was the Industrial Revolution European? And part of the answer is that financial markets developed earlier and more fully in Europe than elsewhere in the world. And Europe's political geography and physical geography, which gave rise to the need for states to borrow, is part of the explanation for that financial development. So we think this focus on public debt can help us understand a variety of larger issues in economic history.
Of course, along with sovereign borrowing comes sovereign default. There certainly has been a lot of that throughout the course of history. Latin America, very prominent in this story. What has the history of that been? How often did they default? What were the reasons for it? What consequences did they have for the defaulters? And what consequences did it have for the creditors? How badly damaged were all the parties to these transactions that turned sour?
It's a great question, Doug, that eludes a compact answer. States default because of a combination of reckless lending and indiscriminate borrowing.
Yeah, the borrowers gets the blame, but the lender has some responsibility as well, right?
Yeah, it takes two to tango. So if you look at historical examples like we do in the book, there was a famous episode starting in the 1860s when the government of Honduras borrowed in order to build a canal across the isthmus. The problem being that Honduras has mountains, so it's a whole lot harder to build a canal there. The lenders didn't take this fully into account. They were not familiar with the geography of Honduras. The government was overambitious, so it wasn't able to repay what it borrowed. It wasn't able to complete the canal. It's actually continuing to try to build, even today, a combination of railway and canal across the isthmus there. So there were repeated defaults in the 1860s, in the 1870s, when Honduras was unable to repay. It was shut out of the capital market for quite some time. Exporters of mahogany and other things from Honduras found it difficult to get the credit they needed in order to export. So the economy stagnated, suffered, and it took a generation and a half until the 1890s for them to get back into the global capital market, at which point they ran into trouble and defaulted again. So among the questions that one has to ask is, why do the lenders repeat this mistake, if indeed it's a mistake? And we think the answer is partly they are richly compensated. They earn a much higher interest rate in the period where the government is still repaying. Partly they are have always been less than fully informed about what's going on in these far-flung parts of the world. So that's the 19th century history. It was also the history of Latin America and other parts of the world in the 1920s and 30s and in the 1970s and 80s.
And of course, we focus on all the debt drama, all the defaults and the troubles. But in most cases, those are worked through. The debts are restructured somehow or other, and everyone lives to tell another story.
Yeah. So the lenders come back because they are sufficiently well compensated during the period where the country is still paying. And if the country stops paying, it typically doesn't do so forever. Instead, it initiates negotiations with its creditors. It agrees to pay 50 cents on the dollar or whatever. And the creditors eventually conclude that half a loaf is better than none, and business as usual resumes.
Okay, now let's conclude by looking at the recent history of the U.S. In the 1980s, the Reagan tax cuts led to an explosion of the federal deficit. There was an awful lot of worry, starting almost immediately, extending into the 90s, that this is going to lead us to ruin. Bill Clinton came into office, brought down that debt, and ran a few years of surpluses, and then we're back on the debt train again. How do you explain that? What was responsible for that little bout of prudence that didn't last very long?
The bout of prudence in the 1990s was really an exceptional period for the United States. We had a bout of good luck, or the fiscal authorities had an interlude of good luck, where the economy was growing. Productivity growth was unusually rapid in the second half of the 1990s. That's the positive side of the coin. And the economy was also being pumped up by the dot-com bubble. So all of that made for buoyant revenues. even though the 1990s was the period of Newt Gingrich and all that, political polarization was less than it is now. I think we can agree on that, which made cross-party compromise on things like budgets and moving toward budget balance easier. So it was that combination of reasonable prudence on the spending side and unusually buoyant revenues that made for a stable and even declining ratio of debt to national income, to the point where at the end of the 1990s, people, investors, were worrying that the federal government debt would disappear, that it would be extinguished.
That's a quaint worry.
And that seems unbelievable from the point of view of 2021.
Now we've forgotten all that prudence. We saw the explosion of debt during the financial crisis a decade ago, and now the COVID debt's adding to that further. And it doesn't seem like there's much of a political constituency for whittling down that debt. Wall Street's interest in austerity has largely disappeared. The bond market vigilantes seem to have hung up their guns. What happened there? Have we been narcotized by all the free money from the Fed, or what? And should we worry about this enormous debt overhang that is after these two gigantic bailouts?
What me worry? Yes, I do think there will come a point where we're going to have to start worrying again. What has really eliminated these worries, subdued such worries for the moment, is not so much the Fed as the fact that interest rates on public debt and on almost everything have declined pretty steadily for the last two or three decades. So federal government debt in the hands of the public is now triple relative to the size of the economy, what it was at the turn of the century. But how much interest we pay on that debt is no higher than it was at the turn of the century because of that decline over the last two decades of the level of interest rates. I personally think that interest rates have declined not so much because of the Fed, but because of the high savings of China and Saudi Arabia and Germany, because of increasing in income inequality, which has put more income and wealth in the hands of high-income folks who have high savings rates. If those trends now begin to reverse, as they well might, more concern about inequality. So we change the tax system accordingly. China turns into more of a normal country with a social safety net. So household savings rates there decline. At that point, interest rates will begin to go up. And then this heavier debt we've inherited can become more of a problem. However, I think the more fundamental issue is that what we've learned in the last couple of decades is that crises happen more frequently than we used to think. And there's going to be another novel coronavirus or financial crisis or climate-related disaster. And governments are going to have to respond to that emergency by mobilizing all available resources, by issuing more debt. So I think it's prudent to fix the roof on the house before it rains, to do some debt consolidation once this recovery is secure and we're confident that COVID-19 is behind us. So I do think people are overly sanguine because interest rates are low right now and the economy is expanding again. There's no guarantee that we're going to have that kind of smooth sailing going forward.
And what about inflating our way out of the problem, inflating our way out of the debt overhang?
Yeah, I think the United States, where the average maturity of government debt is relatively short, on the order of 5 years, has little ability to inflate away the debt, to grow the denominator of the debt to GDP ratio by inflating GDP. A country like the UK, where the average maturity of government debt is 14 years, they have more scope for doing that. In addition, I think the investors in government bonds, we're talking about pension funds and insurance companies and individual investors, would not be happy about being expropriated by inflation. And I think stability culture is pretty deeply ingrained in our central banking community. So Jay Powell and company are under a lot of criticism for inflation at the moment, but I think they're really committed to their 2% plus or minus a percentage point inflation target. And they will not allow inflation to stray much above 2 or 3% for an extended period. So you can have me back in a couple of years, Doug, and we can visit that forecast.
Well, there's an awful lot of strange things going on in the financial system these days that a bout of higher interest rates might cause a lot of fireworks.
Indeed, both financially and politically.
I was Barry Eichengreen, professor of economics and political science at Berkeley and co-author of In Defense of Public Debt, published by Oxford University Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Electronic Future by Helena Hauff, featuring Paris the Black Foo, part of a collection celebrating the 30th anniversary of Trésor Records, a label that celebrates the Detroit-Berlin musical axis. Till next week, bye.